Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Peer Training Network conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. I would now like to introduce your host for today's call, Ms. Susan Kanak. Ms. Kanak, you may begin.
Thank you very much, Lee. Welcome to our fourth and last Child Welfare Peer Training Network call of 2008. I'm Susan Kanak from the National Child Welfare Resource Center for Organizational Improvement at the Muskie School in Portland, Maine, and I'm so glad you could join our call today. Our topic is planning effective training evaluation, which, as I know and you know, is a hot topic in the field right now. Since some of the participants on the call today are new, I want to give just a bit of background about how this network came to be and who's in it. This peer training network is comprised of more than 200 people who are interested in child welfare training. Some members are trainers, some are curriculum writers, some manage training, some do it all. As many of you remember, this network started 5 years ago to give people interested in exchanging ideas on child welfare training a forum. Participants in this network are people interested in learning from each other and getting and giving feedback on various child welfare training topics. To date, we've covered topics such as new worker training, supervisory training, classroom management skills. The topics are suggested by members of this network. Early on, we decided to keep the membership in the group open to all interested persons and to encourage conversations that are informal, practical, and participatory. We believe that this really is a peer network, one where network members set the topics for the calls and suggest presenters, if any. On some of our calls, like this one today, we have presenters to advance the discussion. In other calls, we don't have presenters. The participants are the presenters, if you will, by sharing their thoughts, experiences, lessons learned on the topic of the day. This peer training network provides all of us with many opportunities to connect with child welfare trainers, managers, curricula developers, and evaluators across the country. What we have in common is an interest in improving the lives of children and families through effective child welfare training, and an interest in constantly improving that training. I'm pleased to be a member of this group, and I'm glad that you also are involved. We're not going to do a roll call today, as we have far too many people on the line, and our topic needs our full attention. So I have just a couple more introductory comments before we get into the content of the call. For your information, because this topic is of such interest to the child welfare training community, I've been asked to widely distribute the content of this call. So this call is being taped and will be available for download on the NRCOI's website, which is www.nrcoi.org. www.nrcoi.org. I don't know if the time of year will make any difference, but usually the calls that are taped are available within a day or two after the call. So look for that. I think you'll find it a good resource and also something you might want to share with your colleagues who could not be on the call today. Also, before we close today, Charmaine Britton of the Butler Institute at Denver University, who many of you know, is going to give all of us a brief update on the new workforce grant and put out a request for information. So before we wrap up our call, we'll have an opportunity to hear about that new grant. Okay, let's move on to today's topic. The topic for today's call is how to plan for effective training evaluation. Our presenters will review the steps necessary to strategically plan for evaluating your training. Using California's framework for training evaluation as a guide, They will address the key issues that need to be resolved in order to evaluate training effectively. We're fortunate to have four gifted speakers on this call today. Two of the presenters are longstanding members of this peer training network, and all have vast experience evaluating child welfare training. Let me introduce the presenters to you. I suspect that you will recognize many of the names as they are locally and nationally known as experts in the field of child welfare training and child welfare training evaluation. First is Barry Johnson. Barry is the Director of Child Welfare In-Service Training at California Social Work Education Center at the University of California. Berkeley School of Social Welfare. Whew, you have a longer address than I do, Barry. Barry provides leadership for CalSWEX, that's what I'm used to calling it, coordination of statewide training efforts, including development and implementation of Common Core training and strategic planning for a statewide training evaluation system. He also leads CalSWEX's efforts to implement evidence-based practice in child welfare and to address disparities in the child welfare system. So there's a number of topics, Barry, we might invite you to come back and talk on. Let me also introduce Leslie Zeitler. Leslie is the training and evaluation specialist for the Regional Training Academy Coordination Project at CalSWEC. Ms. Zeitler is responsible for coordinating and implementing statewide training and evaluation efforts and for providing technical assistance to the California Regional Training Academies and to all 58 California counties. Not a small job, very well. Next, we have Cindy Perry. Cindy is a consultant specializing in program evaluation in human services. She's had over 25 years' experience in evaluation in child welfare, juvenile justice, and education programs. She has been a co-facilitator for the strategic planning process for training evaluation in California and provided test development and data analysis for the Common Core evaluation. I can also say that Cindy is an evaluator who is able to bridge many different skill sets and speaks English and in a way translates some very sophisticated concepts for those of us who are not as sophisticated in this field as she is. So she's a wealth of information, and we're very happy to have her. And finally, our good friend Jane Birdie. Jane is a child welfare consultant specializing in training and training evaluation. She has worked for 6 years with CalSWEC on the training evaluation project. When I first came into the field of child welfare training, I heard about this curriculum developer guru and training evaluator guru and just wonderful person, and it was Jane Birdie. So it's my pleasure to welcome Jane, Cindy, Leslie, and Barry to this call. I thank them right now and will later on for their willingness to share their expertise with us. And let me turn the call now over to Barry.
Thanks, Susan. Good morning or afternoon, everybody, depending on where you are in the country. My task here is to sort of set things up a little bit and talk a little bit about the context of our training evaluation projects. And our strategic plan for training evaluation. So I'm going to start with a very brief story that some of you may have heard before involving the PIP, the federal PIP in California, the first round. And this is the story of a big meeting with all of the big stakeholders, including the Region 9 representatives for California, when we were systematically going through our proposed PIP and talking about what we were actually going to do to reach substantial conformity for our PIP. And I was there for the training system and kind of waiting my turn as we got through the items and you know, had a few things that I was going to say. And before I could say anything in the training, when the training sections came up, the guy actually was sitting right next to me from a large and powerful county administrator raised his hand and said, well, come on, folks, do we even know, if we're talking about outcomes, does training even affect outcomes? Do we even know at all if it has any effect on outcomes? I don't think we do. And I sort of, fortunately, we have begun some of our work in training evaluation at that point, so I could sputter on a little bit because I was so surprised that he said that about what the efforts that we had made to link training to outcomes. But what kind of my goal throughout this process is to be able to answer that question for people. And I think it's an important question to answer in the especially in a time of sort of tight resources and accountability. So that's just a sort of kickoff story. I'm going to start out with a very brief bit of context about the California Child Welfare Training System and the California system, because I think you'll need to know a little bit about this to make sense of why we did what we did. One important thing to know, we are a county-administered system with state funding and oversight. We have 58 counties. Counties are particularly strong in our system, meaning they have a lot of influence, and the County Welfare Directors Association is a very strong entity. Our training system is also complex. We have, as part of our consortium at CalSWEC, we have now 19 schools of social welfare that participate in the stipend program, and there are 5 regions, all with different university-based training programs that provide the in-service training. And all of those are funded independently. The 4 that are not in Los Angeles, the 4 regions that are not Los Angeles are funded by the California Department of Social Services on separate grants. And Los Angeles County funds a consortium within LA that provides their in-service training. And several large counties, especially at Los Angeles, have very large training shops of their own within their county. So a whole bunch of people are doing a whole bunch of training at all times in California. And CalSWEC, our organization, has a contract with CDSS to help to sort of coordinate those efforts and set standards. We now are sort of the holders of the Common Core curriculum in California for line workers and supervisors. So we have, because this system evolved in a very disparate manner, we have had a long effort at getting things more standardized, and we've made a couple of attempts at that, and now we finally have a more standardized curriculum. And evaluation was key. Looking at evaluation and planning for evaluation was key in sort of turning around that corner and getting to a more standardized curriculum. So we set up a number of structures, which I think is important to think about the structures that you set up when you're talking about evaluating training, because it involves a lot of review of curriculum and a lot of agreements of multiple entities who are doing the training, even multiple trainers who are doing the training if you have a more simple state-run system. So we set up a committee that meets quarterly, the Statewide Training and Education Committee, that's charged with sort of coordinating and addressing these statewide training issues, including the Common Core curriculum. And then underneath that, we set up subcommittees to do this sort of nitty-gritty work. One is the macro eval team, and that's what mostly we're going to talk about here, that's charged with implementing the evaluation and planning for the evaluation. And one is the curriculum development oversight group, or CDOG, which is charged with doing the nitty-gritty of curriculum development. And all of those, under the oversight of our statewide training and education committee, those groups have to have an interface with each other because the curriculum affects the evaluation affects the curriculum. So that's the system we have set up. We also thought it would be important, and the little work that we had done before the first Child and Family Services review, was to begin a strategic plan, and I also knew it would be helpful to have consultants who were a neutral part of the force in the process to help us to do that. And we put on an RFP a long time ago, and Jane and Cindy were the ones that got that, and I always say, you know, thank God for that. So along comes the CFSR, our first CFSR, and after that fateful meeting, one of the key things that we did to move things along was in the eventual PIP that came up after that meeting, the training evaluation, well, standardizing the curriculum and using developing a training evaluation framework to evaluate that curriculum was an action item step in our PIP. In fact, it was the biggest action item in the training sections of our PIP. for the last round. So it really added a lot of accountability for us. We started meeting much more frequently than quarterly for our statewide training and education committee meeting, and that really became the focus of all our work. Once we had that, we could really get down to the key decisions that needed to be made. And the other thing that we had done sort of leading up to this is educated a lot of our stakeholders on the sort of basics of training evaluation so that people would sort of have at least some understanding of what we were talking about when we were doing this. And I'm going to turn it over to Jane and Cindy to go over very briefly just those basic assumptions of the training evaluation model that were used.
Okay, thanks, Barry. This is Jane. For participants, if you could go ahead and open the slide that you'll see called AHA, Levels of Training Evaluation. As Barry said, a basic question is what can training evaluation tell us about the effectiveness of training? And then another question that follows that right away is what do you want to evaluate? So if you look at this slide here, you'll see what represents an attempt that Cindy and I undertook about 12 or 13 years ago to try to flesh out a framework for answering that question. And we were both working at American Humane Association at the time, and that's why this is called the AHA Levels of Training Evaluation. At that point, the key and still really seminal work, one of the seminal works done in training evaluation, was by a man named Kirkpatrick, who had outlined four levels of training evaluation in the late 50s. And those are not labeled here, but you'll see where it says level 1, 2, 3, and 4 in blue. And as he outlined those levels, he saw the first one, level 1, as the reaction of the students to the training. Level 2 was what learning, meaning knowledge or capability, did students achieve. Number 3 was what behavior would you actually see as a result of the training. And number 4 was what results would you see, meaning results that had an impact on the job that they were doing. As Cindy and I looked at that, we decided we wanted to kind of flesh that out a little bit more in a way that would help us to design actual training evaluation projects at very specific levels. So we first conceptualized the training as an entity, and that's the black bar that you see down the middle, and that various levels of training evaluation were either more or less closely aligned to the training. And what that means is how much interference by other variables could affect the findings of evaluation at that level. And as you can see, the farther down that apple peel you go, more and more events could impact the effect that what we learn about training at that evaluation level. So, for instance, if you go almost to the bottom to client outcomes, you would see readily that many things could affect client outcomes besides training, the training itself. So in looking at these levels, you'll see here that the first we thought that was closest to the training itself was the course itself, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in terms of a formative evaluation of the course. Then the next two levels are the satisfaction and opinion of the trainees themselves, and we all do that. Those are the happiness sheets that we do. Then there's the knowledge acquisition. We usually do those with multiple choice or true false knowledge tests, as well as the knowledge comprehension, and we tend to get at that by using short scenarios to see whether people can apply knowledge to some case scenarios. Then we look at skill demonstration. And by skill demonstration, what we mean is skill demonstration within the classroom setting, not back on the job. And so there we look at the ability to take the information from the training, focusing on the skills instead of the knowledge, focusing on the skills that are taught and whether people are showing some level of mastery, entry-level mastery of the skill within the training classroom itself. Then we go to skill transfer, which is on the job. This is where we're looking to see whether transfer of learning has taken place. Then to agency impact, that's the kind of the PIP level, where are we getting at, is the training helping to helping the agency to achieve the level of impact that it wants. Then all the way to client outcomes, are clients achieving client goals, at least in part, as a result of the training that staff or foster parents or anybody else has had. And then lastly, to the community impact. So those are the levels that we fleshed out from the Kirkpatrick model. And I'm going to turn it over to Cindy, and she's going to talk about how we think about the relationship between all of those levels in terms of actual training evaluation designs.
Hi, everybody. The way that we thought about putting this together was with a concept that we've been calling the chain of evidence. And what that refers to is combining evidence from all these levels, various levels of training evaluation, in such a way that you're building a reasonable person kind of case for the involvement of training in whatever outcome you're working toward. We all know that the bottom line with training evaluation is always a question of, well, how does that affect child well-being, permanency, safety, child welfare outcomes for children and families? And we usually, for various reasons, can't do a very definitive job of evaluating training's role in that. For one thing, it's very resource intensive, and for another thing, it requires usually large, large numbers of participants if you can't do random assignment, which you usually can't do. So this is kind of another way of thinking about that, where we're looking at building a case by showing that the training is related in some logical way to what you would expect to see as an outcome improvement. And there's an example in your handouts that looks at this for family group decision making. And in the case of something like family group decision making training, you might, for example, expect that if you involve families more and you take a more strength-based focus, that you might have reduced time to permanency, you might have higher reunification rates, there might be some logical connections. Or if you're very lucky, you might have some evidence-based practice information that would help you build that connection. If you can do that, and then you can in turn show that people have learned what you're teaching, they've acquired the knowledge and skills, and then they've put those into practice, and they've implemented what you've taught with reasonable fidelity to the model or with a reasonable skill level, then you observe that there's been a change, you've made a case for the involvement of training. You haven't necessarily ruled out other explanations for things that affect those outcomes, but you've made a case for the fact that training has some part in that. And what we tried to do in California in building this framework was to think in terms of levels and think in terms of providing evidence at various levels that could then be combined into a whole picture that would suggest that the training evaluation systems are having an impact on outcomes. What I wanted to talk about next, just for a few minutes, is how we went about some of the decision-making that's involved in setting up that framework once we had those basic concepts in place. And in setting up the framework, probably the first thing that we talked about, and one of the most important things that we talked about, is what the purpose was for why we were doing the evaluation. All of your decisions about the way you're going to design your evaluation, the way you're going to set up your tests or other instruments to collect your information, all flow from the purpose that you have for doing the evaluation. And there are a number of purposes that you can have. Some of those have to do with the program level, and some have to do with the individual level. We in California chose to focus on the program level because what we were primarily concerned with was showing that there was a system in place of curriculum and evaluation that could help to ensure that people had a consistent preparation, that people had certain basic knowledge and skills as a whole, statewide. So we were focused on group-level data. We were focused on the program itself, getting feedback for program improvement, and helping to document for accountability purposes that the training program was making a difference. You could also look at individual level data, and when we talk in a couple of minutes about the concept of high stakes, low stakes, this comes into play there. You could also design your evaluation to look at individual level data. You might, for example, have questions having to do with providing feedback on certain skill areas or certain knowledge areas to the person and to their supervisor for future development. You might have purposes in mind having to do with certification or, you know, somehow being confident that everyone who graduates from the training program reaches a certain level of competence that you're comfortable with in terms of their future work. So there are other kinds of purposes that you could have in mind, but our purpose in this case was to look at the program itself and program improvement. In addition to that, let me back up first for a second. That drove some of the subsequent decisions that we made. And one of the subsequent decisions that we made because of that interest was that we wanted to take kind of a broad look at the knowledge that people were acquiring as a result of going through the Common Core training and whether or not there was an improvement from pretest to post-test. So it drove the design decision to use a pretest and a post-test for the majority of our knowledge tests. It also drove the decisions having to do with the kind of testing that we put together. We put together basically 30-item knowledge tests. It was kind of a negotiation with the curriculum developers and the trainers because, as everybody knows, there's always a trade-off between the time that you get to spend on doing the training and the time you get to spend on evaluating the training. With this purpose, that was appropriate because what we were doing was we were sampling from the content. If we were trying to make decisions about whether an individual needed to follow up on specific areas before they practiced or if we were certifying individuals, we would have needed a much, much longer test because we would have had to really do exhaustive coverage of the curriculum and really ensure that they knew everything that they were being taught and being exposed to a level that we were comfortable with. That gets into the notion of high, medium, and low stakes. The majority of the testing that we're doing in California is what we would consider to be low stakes. It's the data that we're collecting is for program improvement, not to make decisions about individuals. People make up their own ID code that we use to connect things like their pretest and their post-test and the various pieces of the evaluation. So only they know who they are. So there's really no personnel consequence for the majority of the training. Where we got into some of these other ideas was there in one of the regions within the state, they do have a tradition of providing some testing with their core academy and providing information back to the trainee and to their supervisor about how they did on the tests that they've been given. And they wanted to continue doing that. So we got into discussing some exceptions for that particular region, and that led us to the idea of a medium stakes. You don't see that in the literature particularly, but what we mean by that medium stakes is that there's no personnel consequence attached. If you don't do very well on the test, you won't be fired, you won't be reassigned, nothing of a personnel nature should happen, but that information will be provided to you and to your supervisor so that you can work on the areas where you didn't do as well and maybe improve. So that's our medium stakes notion, and there is one area within the state that uses their tests in that way. And Barry could maybe talk to you a little bit more about this, but that required some exceptions from the Institutional Review Board that approved our process. So there were some procedural issues that we had to go through with that. And then, as I mentioned before, finally, high stakes is if you're making certification decisions or decisions where there's a personnel consequence attached. We, after a fair bit of discussion, decided not to go in that direction for numerous technical and resource issues. It's also a union issue. If you're in a union state, it gets very complex. There are various organizations like the American Psychological Association that put out whole handbooks on test construction, and you need to go through several hundred pages of requirements to get to the kind of test that would stand up for this purpose. So it is a very complex undertaking that we elected not to try to approach in this situation. And then finally, I just wanted to talk for a couple of minutes about the levels of evaluation we chose. Jane gave you a brief introduction to the AHA levels, and we did use that as our model. We added for California a level, we called it level zero, because we needed to do some groundwork just in understanding statewide who was taking what class and whether people were completing things within required time frames in order to provide some of that basic information to the state. We focused most of our attention on the broader, in the first round of the strategic planning, on getting a broad look at what people were acquiring as a result of going through training. In doing this, we focused on a knowledge level. We had a lot of discussion, and to some extent on a skill level, which I'll get to in a second. We had a lot of discussion about how to do the focus in such a way that we would balance out the need for some common exposure to key concepts, but also provide some ability for the localities to meet their individual needs. So we identified what we called initially the Big Five and then later the Big Six, which were areas that we thought were the core of the core. And in those core of the core areas, which were child maltreatment identification, human development, case planning, placement and permanency, forgetting one, risk and safety assessment, those were our first targets for evaluation. We first looked at the idea of doing testing, knowledge testing, to get a broad look at what people were acquiring in those key areas. And then we decided we wanted to focus on one of those, and in this case it was child maltreatment identification, to take to a skill level. We focused on one initially because it was a resource issue. If you are a curriculum developer, I'm sure you're familiar with how much time it takes to just take a particular area, competency area, and teach to skill. When you're evaluating to skill, that's just that much more time. So there's a time issue. There's another resource issue in the complexity of developing evaluations at this level. So we chose one area, the child maltreatment area, to focus on in the beginning. We are now thinking in terms of expanding those in a second round of strategic planning, which we'll be starting to discuss soon. And at this point, I think I'd like to turn it over to Leslie to talk a little bit more about some of the resource issues and some of the responsibilities and the way that we've assigned those.
Okay. Thank you, Cindy. Good afternoon. So as you might imagine, in a state the size of California, that this is a really resource-intensive effort. We have five regional training academies which serve our 58 counties. And so when I talk about resources in the next few minutes, I'm also going to talk about what is a centralized function and what's a local function. And when I say local, I mean one of the five regional training academies. So one of the main issues or main resources is personnel time, both at the local level and centrally here at CalSWEC. We need personnel to distribute the tests, make sure that they are the correct versions for each of the curricula, and since the curricula get updated on an ongoing basis, we have to keep up with that and make sure that each of our representatives at the local level know which version of test to use. And also we need local level personnel to send us the data, because then what is a centralized function is entry, data cleaning, and analysis, and also keeping track of an inventory of what data has been received and sent on for analysis. Another centralized function that we have here in California is that in terms of test development, we have personnel. So, for instance, Jane and Cindy help us with the design of the knowledge tests and the embedded evaluations. We also have costs for scanning and copying tests and mailing tests. And in terms of when we have a boom year, which we did in fiscal year 07-08, we processed about 24,000 pages of training evaluation data. We actually, for the first time, had to use the services of a data entry vendor because we didn't have the staffing to keep up with it last year. So those were associated costs. We also have local staff participate in the evaluation review process. So when we are revising either knowledge tests or the embedded evaluations, when curricula get revised, we do need subject matter experts to participate in the process of the revisions of each of those respective tests. And any additional staff or consultant time for analysis and reporting to our regional training counties, to the counties and to the state itself. Again, that's with great assistance from Cindy and Jane. That's another centralized function. I'm trying to think. I think we're going to move on to kind of where we are in terms of our progress. And, of course, if people have questions about resources at the end of our presentation, feel free to ask. But I know that we're behind time, so I'm going to move us along. In terms of our progress so far in California, I'm going to ask Jane just to update us on the level-by-level developments of our training evaluation framework, and then I'll talk a little bit more about how we use our findings.
Okay, thanks very much, Leslie. This is Jane again. And if you'll look at the handout called the CDSS Common Framework for Assessing Effectiveness of Training, this is a framework that we put together when we first started 6 years ago, and we update it periodically to see where we are and to help us in thinking about where we want to go. And as Cindy said, that's going to be a major 2009 effort for the whole group of us, meaning all the people at CALSWEC, all the regional training academies, and some county participants too. And we will be looking at a strategic plan based on where we want to be going and what we've achieved so far. So this framework here is a way for us to take a look at that in terms of the training evaluation efforts that we have done so far. And the way that we put this framework together was to first identify the level of training evaluation using the model that that Cindy and I talked about, and then to identify the scope, just how much are we trying to do within that level at this point in time, and then to describe that effort, then to identify any decisions that are pending. And for all of these, there were, in the beginning, of course, 6 years ago, many decisions pending. Some of them we have pretty much worked through. Then to have a resources column, because as Leslie said, the resource implications for the regional training academies, for CALSWEC, are pretty great, and they can be things that you can sort of minimize until you really get into them and see what they involve. So we track those there, and then our status and timeframes is the last column. So I'm just going to go through these quite quickly so you can see what we've accomplished and how that leads to what we plan to do next, as well as what Leslie will talk about in a few minutes, which is how we use these findings. Our first level, as Cindy said, was that we just needed to develop a good tracking system for attendance, because as in many states that are state supervised and county administered, there wasn't at that time 6 years ago a way to track statewide all participation in key key training, such as Common Core for workers and supervisors, is. So we developed a system for doing that, and as Cindy said, and this will relate to the second level, the level 1B, we associated not just names, which we needed for, of course, the tracking purposes, but we developed a separate system for self-generated identifications that helped us to link various levels of evaluation. But at this level 1A, we were just looking to put together a tracking system that would allow us to be able to report back in a PIP that very key issue about whether all staff had received required training. And so that is as is in place as of this last summer. The second level was this demographics, and again, we wanted this because we wanted to be able to see what kinds of patterns there were in terms of learning at various levels that we would be evaluating. But we also wanted to be sure that it wasn't identifiable to individuals. And so we developed a system for self-generated identifications. And as you can see, by looking at this resource column, there are huge resource issues in terms of making sure that these data are collected and verified. Lots of times people don't write their self-generated ID in a way that is always clear, so there needs to be a lot of work sometimes in cleaning that data. But it has really been very helpful in allowing us to look at patterns of learning that are helpful to us in doing what we primarily want to do with that kind of finding, which is to see whether there are certain patterns that indicate to us that we need to, one, make changes in curriculum, or think about some follow-up to classroom training that eventually could be helpful to people. And that could be things that are done within the county itself through supervision, or perhaps later. We haven't gotten to this in any great way yet, but looking at what training could do to link up with transfer of learning activities in the field. Then we go to level two, which is the formative evaluation, and this is the evaluation of the curricula as they're being developed. We developed several ways of doing this. One was a Delta Plus instrument, and that was used by many observers who sat in on revised training and gave really excellent feedback through these instruments that we had put together, and then met to help us think through what were the implications for how we wanted training changed. Curriculum changed as it got developed. And this is very intense resource issues for both the regional training academies and the counties, because those are largely the sources of personnel to be able to really sit through and evaluate training curriculum as it's being developed. And as you'll see by the last column there, that we have completed revisions that involve this level of formative evaluation for the courses that are outlined there. Satisfaction opinion, all RTAs were already doing that, and in California they can use their own formats for doing that, or one that is developed by CalSWEC. The next level is the knowledge level, and as Cindy said, this was one of the levels of evaluation that we tackled first and developed fairly large item banks for a number of, not all, but a number of the modules of the Common Core curriculum for workers. And from those item banks, we pull 30 items at a time to test the test, meaning to test those items to see how they're performing. And the again, a huge amount of work by the regional training academies goes into helping with the development of these items and taking a look at the performance data that of the items that, that Cindy analyzes and seeing whether there are problems with items, whether some need to be eliminated from the item bank, whether some need to be revised. And that will be an ongoing process because as curriculum gets updated, the knowledge item bank needs to be updated too. Next level, number five, is the skills during training. And this is where, during the training, we use what is called the embedded evaluation to see how well people are beginning to master a skill that is part of the curriculum. And as was said, I think Cindy mentioned that we began that process with child maltreatment identification. There are modules in identifying child maltreatment, both physical and abuse and neglect, and then another module on sexual abuse. And those were the two that we developed first, and those involve scenarios where people, participants, use an instrument that they've been taught to use to make decisions about whether child physical abuse and child sexual abuse do or do not exist in those case scenarios. And those have been particularly useful, I think, in helping us to go back to the curriculum and see where things needed to be clarified and beefed up. And as you'll see, we've gotten two of them in place, the two child maltreatment ones. One on assessment has been piloted, and we're looking to extend that to other versions of assessment that is of assessment training that is being done. And then another one is being developed already for the supervision module. Then the next level is the transfer level. And this is where you would evaluate transfer of learning in the field. And in California, we're looking at that, have not developed that yet, but are looking at that around the case planning module. And then the level seven, which is the agency and client outcomes, we have not done anything directly on that, but are using, as Cindy described, the chain of evidence to see to what extent we are having an impact on outcomes at both the agency and client level. So this system of the keeping track of what we're doing has been very useful to us, both to be able to tune into the specific training evaluation projects and to keep in mind the overall framework and all of the levels of evaluation that we want to be looking at. And it'll be a major tool that we use with the strategic planning process for the next phase of training evaluation that we do in 2009. And Leslie, I'll turn it back over to you, and you can talk about use of the findings.
Okay, thanks, Jane. So we use our findings in a couple different ways. One, for revision of curricula, and I'll give an example of that in just a moment. And second, we also send our reports to trainers, management personnel, and other stakeholders. So in terms of curricula revision, the example I would use is for our child maltreatment identification part one curriculum, which is identification of physical abuse. And it has gone through several iterations, both the curriculum itself and the evaluation. There are four test scenarios, and then there are sets of test questions for each scenario. And based on the results that we've received for each of the different versions, we've discovered that either something wasn't clear in the scenario or something was not clear about the elements that we've asked trainees to identify in the actual curriculum, or something was not clear about the language itself on the test forms, for instance, the instructions. So it's been really helpful to us to really clarify what we want trainees to leave the room with. Are they actually getting the elements that are a central part of the curriculum? And are they able to transfer what they've learned into the testing situation and to identify whether or not physical abuse has occurred for a given scenario? And in terms of sharing the reports with trainers and management and other stakeholders, I can't think of an instance this may have occurred, and Cindy may remember this or not, but for example, if we had a test class, and I'm thinking of a knowledge test situation, where several of the test questions were missed consistently by most trainees or all trainees, that would tell us that there's a curriculum delivery issue, and that would be feedback we could possibly give to trainers to say, you know, we noticed for this test class, the majority of the people were missing these questions or these one or two questions. In terms of management and other stakeholders, we can tell them on the basis of these reports what kind of learning has been going on in the classroom. So for courses where we have knowledge pre- and post-tests, we're able to say we've had significant changes in the amount of learning that has occurred in the classroom. Do you want to add anything to that, Cindy?
No, I don't think so, Leslie.
No? Okay. I was wondering if you might. Okay. So another way that we use our findings, and I'm thinking of demographics, and this is where Cindy can correct me if I'm wrong, but we've been finding that there have been statistically significant differences on a consistent basis between test performance from white trainees to test performance by African-American, Asian-American, and Latino trainees. And so for us, that means we have to take another look at what's going on in the training room, at how we're testing, and we'll be talking about this in just a moment about the strategic plan, but it requires another look for us as evaluators about what we may be doing to contribute to this effect, if anything. And so one of the things that has come up that Cindy did some research about was the possibility of stereotype threat. And can you briefly describe that, Cindy, and then I'll go back to the strategic plan?
Well, I don't know if we want to go too deeply into
no,
this, but I think
no.
This is an issue that if any of you who have testing programs may be familiar with or who are contemplating a testing program should be familiar with. And unfortunately, these kinds of demographic differences do crop up from time to time and fairly frequently with respect to race and ethnicity. There are a number of ways that you can look at this, and we've really gone the extra mile in California to try to look at this because we're committed to having the test function fairly for everybody. What we are looking at right now are some different explanations for why this may be occurring, and we've been identifying specific test items that seem to be the culprits in some cases. We've also been looking at this concept of stereotype threat, which Leslie alluded to, which comes from a whole body of social psych literature that talks about people performing more poorly when they think that they can be basically stereotyped on the basis of a negative group perception. So if you as a member of a minority group feel that you'll be expected to perform more poorly, that can kind of become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So, thank you, Cindy. So what I was thinking of in terms of briefly talking about that is that when we look at how we use our findings, it's about how we improve curriculum and curricula delivery, as well as how we improve our evaluation process. And so with that, when we're looking at our next strategic plan, which we are in the process of in the next year, we're just about at the tail end of our first strategic plan, and we're now getting into our second one, is we're going to be asking our stakeholders, which include our regional training academies and some of our county representatives, about what they would like to see happen for training evaluation in the next 5 or so years. And so one of the things that came up in terms of use of findings and how that gets integrated into the strategic plan is, do we want to do a comparative analysis for different test classes about when we administer the demographics form as part of our trying to address potential issues of stereotype threat? So that would be an example. Also in our strategic plan, we're looking to get to transfer of learning, the skill level. And that would require a whole additional set of resources. That requires quite a bit of staff time. And so part of what's going on, and as I assume that this is going on in other states around the nation, is that we're facing budgetary issues. And that's going to greatly affect how much we can do and what level we can do it in terms of training evaluation, because it is a considerable amount of resources to go to another level of evaluation. So I'm going to move us forward to key lessons learned, and it'll be Barry's turn next to start that off.
Barry. All right. Thanks, guys. And, well, we just wanted to summarize a little bit of the key lessons learned, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about the sort of collaboration and buy-in and working with partners. And one big lesson learned from us is you need a structure in place and one entity to sort of coordinate that. In that case, that was our shop that helped to coordinate it, but we would never have been able to do anything without the active collaboration of the partners who are actually collecting the data and providing the training, because that's something that is a little bit distinctive about us is we actually don't deliver the training. The regional training academies and the University Consortium of Los Angeles actually deliver the training. The other sort of lesson learned in terms of buy-in and getting your training evaluation off the ground is to tie it to your contracting process or tie it to your PIP. Really, you know, make a commitment to evaluating your training and formulating at least a framework that you can hang it on. You know, we'd encourage people to take our framework and modify it however they see fit as a way to start. We've put a lot of work and thought into it, and you guys should benefit from it as well. And just to focus on that, the lesson is you got to really focus on both the sort of line-level communication and all the people who are doing the training, like, you know, trainers plus people who are collecting the evaluation data in the training room plus the people who are getting the data in centrally to locate it and make sure that it's all entered properly, and the people who are analyzing the data. It just you got to really have an open set of communication about that. And that's my set of lessons learned. And Leslie, I think you're going to add a little bit about coordination with the curriculum development process.
Sure. So another, I would say, significant lesson learned is that we really needed to coordinate very closely with our curriculum development process. And Barry mentioned before the curriculum development oversight group, which is a subcommittee of the overarching statewide training and education committee, because for every curriculum that was a common core curriculum that was going to be evaluated, if we didn't work closely with the curriculum developers, editors, then we wouldn't have an evaluation that really reflected what was happening in the training room. So, for instance, we also needed to make sure our version numbers were correct for each curriculum that came out. We'd have to have a new test, a new version number, and make sure that our trainers, in addition to the curriculum people, knew which version to use with which curriculum. We also needed to tighten up our timetables. So for statewide curricula, there are a lot of people involved, and the subject matter experts, the trainers, everybody giving feedback on what they think can improve the next version of the curriculum. So when that happens, there's a timetable that needs to be put into place. And then with the addition of an evaluation for specific curricula, we needed to add more time in, because when there were revisions, we needed to have the most recent version of the curriculum in order to develop the next version of the evaluation. So curricula has to be stable in order for the evaluators to do their jobs. And I think we've just started to get to that place in California, because we did a big push several years ago, and we did all 5 to 7 curricula almost at the same time, simultaneously, and it was quite the effort. And I don't think we'll be doing that again, but it did require quite a bit of coordination with our curriculum developers. I think, Barry, you were going to talk a little bit more about resource implications.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would say, because we need to get to questions, is we tried to be clear throughout our planning process of what resources were necessary, and that's why in our matrix here that sort of guided our framework, the larger report has a framework like this that was our initial report. We really tried to identify all the possible resources that were necessary. And make sure that, you know, everyone's allocating enough people power and resources, because if you're relying on several sites to integrate your data, if one site sort of, you know, has a turnover in staff and things get confused, you can corrupt a lot of your data that way, because you need to keep track of it all and make sure it all matches. I don't know if anyone else had lessons learned add from our panel, because I can end it if people don't.
I think it was just, this is Leslie again, I think it's just the coordination piece was really significant from a test administration process, because we want to make sure that whoever's on the ground at the local level was collecting the data in a way that was helpful. For instance, we've been having in the past a great deal of trouble with our trainee ID codes, because these evaluations, since it's low-stakes testing for most of the trainees throughout the state, we can't follow up with the specific trainees to get them to correct their ID code. So if it doesn't come into us in the way that they've been instructed to do it, we lose that data. So it's been a process of trying to refine a system or a way that we make sure that the trainees understand how to complete their trainee ID code in a consistent manner across all tests through a given core training process. And that affects, of course, data entry and cleaning and then reporting out. So that was a major lesson learned. I don't know if I have anything else.
Okay. Well, let me wrap up. We wanted to wrap up sort of, I mean, on a sort of a big picture note, is that, you know, the main thing for me is from a sort of administrator's perspective that I can now answer that person's question when they say, do we really know whether training has any impact on outcomes? I'm not able to tie it directly because it's really difficult to do that, but I'm able to say in this very sort of, you know, more transparent, more accountable world of Social Services Administration and Child Welfare Administration, that we have a pretty sophisticated way that we evaluate our training, and we know what people get from our training. We know that our training has an impact and it improves people's knowledge and their application of knowledge in the field. So it's been sort of invaluable in that way. And it also had a bunch of side benefits. It really forced our you know, for those of you who might be struggling with getting your curriculum sort of standardized and getting content standardized in curriculum, it's having an evaluation that you have to administer about it really brings you a long way. It really pushed us toward making things standardized in a way that was flexible but still had standardized content so that we could evaluate it. And it made our structures more effective in doing that. I just think my parting shot is sort of that in terms of being accountable, especially in tight budget times, and showing your worth, I think the horse is out of the barn in some sense in terms of whether you evaluate something that you're spending a lot of resources on. And we are evaluating, and I feel good that we are evaluating and have a whole framework in place, even though it has a lot of resources associated with it, especially to get it off the ground. So that we actually are evaluating our training system. So that's what we had, and we're a little over time, but I think we're going to go to questions now, Susan.
Sounds great. Thank you very much. This has been extraordinarily informative. And Lee, why don't we open it up for questions? We've probably got about 8 to 10 minutes for questions, because I do want to make sure that we leave time for Charmaine's conversation on workforce at the end of this call.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Once again, if you have a question or a comment and you'd like to queue up, please press the one key. One moment, please. Our first question comes from the line of Eileen Lally. Your line is open.
Thanks. Hi. Thanks, guys. Great to hear you all. One of the concepts I didn't hear, and I don't know if you figured it in, is the issue of return on investment. We're, as you guys are, undergone of costs of training. And part of this is certainly showing the chain of evidence and that it might make a difference. But have you done anything in actual penciling in costs and benefits?
We haven't done a full-on return on investment analysis. I mean, if you don't evaluate your training, it's really impossible to do that,
right,
get to that level. So I would see our work as sort of the stepping stones to get to that. I don't know if other people have done an ROI on it, but there's a number of things that you have to consider as part of your investment. You know, one of the things that comes to mind that you have to consider is we have this standardized training. So now that's statewide as a result of this and evaluated. So when people have completed the training in one county and they move to another county, they don't necessarily have to complete the training again as long as they have completed it one time. So that's some of the factors that go into an ROI. But we haven't done a formalized ROI for this. But I think if you're just doing satisfaction evaluation, there's really no way to capture ROI. You have to have sort of a chain of evidence model to get there.
Okay, thanks, Barry.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, if you have a question, please press the one key on your touchtone telephone. I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Lee, I have a question. This is Susan. It's something that I think was kind of talked around a little bit during the call, but what I'd like to ask is for child welfare training systems that are just now considering a planning process for training evaluation, what are the key first steps? Can I throw that out to the panel?
Well, this is Jane. One of the things I think is that we really need to figure out who are the key constituents, and it may be broader than you originally think. And one of the first steps is bringing those people together and doing education, because most of us are much more knowledgeable about child welfare and child welfare training than we are about evaluation. So people need to come together and do some learning about that and thinking through how it applies to their own issues.
And I would add that you need to decide what the key decisions are you're going to make, and the first decision you're going to make after you do that education is really what is the purpose of the evaluation, and whether you're going to use it to evaluate individuals or whether you're going to use it to evaluate your training and curriculum only, because that will really guide the level of rigor that you use in your testing process.
Cindy or Leslie, anything to add to that? This has been helpful thus far.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, if you have a question, please press the one key.
I can add one thing to it, but if you want to go first.
This is Cindy. I was thinking, too, that I think some of the key decisions, and building on what Barry said about the purpose, is there needs to be some really good agreement about how the information is going to be shared and used. Even when you do what we did and you agree that you're going to be working on using evaluation for program improvement and not necessarily focusing on individuals, questions arise down the line when you do find individuals who cause you some anxiety. So there's a lot of planning up front and a lot of upfront discussion and agreement that needs to be done to try to keep these things from sandbagging you further down the line.
The only thing that I can think of to add is about the resource side of it, just because it's such a tremendous effort in California. And to ask another state who's doing training evaluation about what kind of resources they need for their particular size state and county system, because we may not necessarily be the best person to give advice about a very small state, but we could give advice about, you know, if you've got a large training population, we could give advice about how we do it in our system and the kind of resources that you would really need to consider and to plan for, because it's really for our local level representatives. They have come back to me and said, you know, ever since we started doing core training and evaluations, the workload has gone up exponentially. Mm-hmm. So it really is a resource consideration as well.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Valerie Decker. Your line is open.
Hello. I had a question and a comment. I work in Indiana, and we're doing something similar, and my comment was that something that helped me with reducing data entry and need for resources in terms of people was online evaluations. So for our 1, 2, and 3, they're all available online. And then the satisfaction, about half the people fill them out online, and then the other half we have to do data entry on. So that was just my comment. And then my question was, our level 2 test, we do not individual modules or classes, but overall at the end of training. And currently our test, the reliability is very, very low. So we're redesigning it. And I was wondering how you went about throwing out questions, or how you figured out which questions were good from your bank.
Yeah, we've gone through an exhaustive process, and starting from the very beginning with writing the questions, we involved all of these content area experts from the various regions in doing editorial review and just letting us know whether that fit well with the curriculum from their point of view or whether they saw problems with the item. And that was sort of the first cut when we got rid of items. One of the other things that we're doing now, too, is developing a test plan. So we're looking at what the competency statements are that are related to knowledge, and looking at how many questions we want to develop tied to each of those. And we even have gone through and identified where the answers are found in the curriculum to make sure that we've got a very, very close tie between what's being taught and what we're asking about. And then sort of a final cut at that is when I do the data analysis, I do a statistical item analysis, because no matter how well we try to anticipate up front, we don't catch everything, and we don't always anticipate all the ways that people will think about the items. So then I look at items that are extremes one way or the other in terms of difficulty, either that nobody gets right or almost everybody gets right, and we get rid of some of the extreme items on the difficulty continuum. And then I also look at an item discrimination index, and what that tells me is whether the people who generally score high on the test also get that item correct or not. And if not, then what that says is there's something confusing going on there, because pretty able people who should not miss this item are missing this item. So there's kind of three levels. There's kind of the stakeholder, expert, editorial level. There's the tying it directly to the curriculum with the plan, and then there's the statistical item analysis.
What kind of improvement do you see and are you happy with?
Oh, like from pre to post?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're getting statistically significant improvement from the beginning, which has made me extraordinarily happy, and pretty strong improvement. In terms of raw score points, I don't know, it's on average it's 2 or 3 points. It's not huge, but overall, given the numbers and the extent of testing, that's turned out to be a highly statistically significant difference for us.
Yeah, on ours, we have like a 5-point improvement generally, and it's statistically significant, but that state's not really happy with that as a practical matter.
Yeah, and I think probably there's a couple of questions there. I mean, there's statistical significance, and then there's sort of substantive significance.
Yeah.
And to the extent that your test is really closely aligned to your curriculum and that a small improvement is a substantive improvement, then you've got a stronger case there. Another way to approach it would be, instead of looking at pre to post differences, looking at more of a criterion reference framework and saying, here are the key things someone should have when they leave the training room, and do they have it? So there's sort of a paradigm shift you could make as well to try to answer that question.
Okay.
And then this is Jane. I think what that suggests too is that if you're just not getting to the level where you would want people to be on the criterion reference test, what can you do to go back and beef up the curriculum? What areas do people seem to not be performing at as well, and what can be done either about the curriculum itself or the delivery of the curriculum? And that's not the same as teaching to the test. That's looking at the key knowledge areas, which of course is what a knowledge test measures, and which ones are really significant according to your expert panel, and what about those areas, based on your testing, do people not seem to be understanding?
This is Susan, and I'm going to have to interrupt this fabulous discussion and say thank you for the questions and the answers, and let you know that we are going to be continuing the conversation on training evaluation at our next peer call, which will be sometime in May. Date to be determined. But I think this might be a good starting point for us to pick up. I mean, what's improvement? How do you know when you see improvement, and how do you make some of those agreements up front? So,
excuse me, Susan, can I say one more thing? Can I just give a plug for folks who are evaluators out there and interested in this, that we have a national symposium every year over the Memorial Day weekend, and people should go on our website and find out about us or contact us, because it's we look forward to having folks come to that. It's a great event with good conversations about these kinds of issues.
That's Gary, great. Thanks for bringing that up. That's my favorite conference of the year. I happen to go, and it's really time well spent. Lee, we have an issue here. Charmaine Britton is a participant on the call. She is our next presenter. How does she let you know to open up her line?
I will open up her line now. Her line is open.
Thank you, Charmaine. Let me just quickly turn it over to you to give us some information and insight on the workforce.
Yes, thank you so much for sharing some of this very precious time with the Peer Training Network. My name is Charmaine Britton. I'm with the University of Denver, and I'm here to talk just very, very briefly about the National Child Welfare Workforce Institute, which is a newly funded service of the Children's Bureau. The purpose of this National Child Welfare Workforce Institute is to raise public awareness about child welfare workforce issues, to help cultivate leadership at multiple levels, specifically mid-managers and supervisors within child welfare agencies, expand the skills and knowledge of professionals, and to institutionalize effective workforce practices. Workforce has been a huge issue, I think, in our field over the last several years, and the Children's Bureau has now recently funded this project, which is part of the Training and Technical Assistance Network. And we're very excited to be a part of it. Along with University of Denver, there are a total of 8 university partners and the National Indian Child Welfare Association who are coming together to operate this National Workforce Institute. There are several components to the institute. One of the things that we'll be developing is a leadership academy for mid-managers as well as for supervisors, so please stay tuned for that. We also are developing and will be offering a traineeship program, and some of you all might have seen messages come through on the listserv about the availability of 9 BSW and MSW programs to receive $110,000 for each of 5 years to support professional education for current and prospective child welfare practitioners. So we're all very excited about that. Another very important component of the Workforce Institute is to conduct a knowledge assessment and management program. And this is to go to existing resources and gather the best and promising practices around leadership and workforce development. What we're trying to do is to harness all of the knowledge and information that's out there regarding workforce and bring together the best pieces of information, the best promising practices in the field around workforce issues. To do that, though, we need your help, and that's why I am allowed this time here on this phone call to put out the call for information related to workforce issues and resources. Many of you might have already received an email from me requesting you to go to a survey site and provide some information about resources that you might have related to workforce, specifically around leadership and supervision, around training curriculum, white papers, monographs, media that you might have available related to workforce issues. We're gathering all of that information, and then at some point in the future, we'll be assessing that information to get out the most relevant and promising practices in the field. If you have such information, training curricula, any kind of white paper, media, even things like realistic job preview videos, and would like to share them, we would very much appreciate that. And I would highly encourage you to perhaps send an email to Susan Knack, because you all have her email, and she could forward it on to me. Or very quickly, I'll provide you my email address, charmaine.britton@du.edu. If you have received the survey link, we sure would appreciate you all filling out the survey on available information and resources that you might have. So that is my very quick 50-cent version about the National Child Welfare Workforce Institute. Does anybody have any questions about it?
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, if you have a question, please press the 1 key. First question comes from Greg Caspila. Your line is open.
Oh, yeah, this is on the other panel. Do you know of any state that uses high-stake evaluation, and how did management deal with the union?
I'm not aware of that. I think I might throw that question out to Cindy and Barry. They might have more information about who uses high-stakes testing. I know some states who use modified testing.
You know, I think there's a lot of components to that question, but I think that Texas has a certification test, although I don't know a lot about it. I think possibly Tennessee. Barry, Jane, anybody else?
Doesn't New York have
New York is working on one.
Yeah.
I don't think it's completely in place yet.
Pennsylvania does have a test, but it's not high stakes. Quite high stakes.
Maine is trying to develop a high stakes test, but I think they got a little stuck in the implementation.
Okay.
You know, it seems like a really good idea to develop a high stakes test until you get into the nitty gritty of it, and you realize what some of the implications are. If your test is not very rigorous, then you're open to a lot of legal challenges for denying people employment based on it. So that's where people run into problems, I think.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, if you have a question, please press the 1 key. I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Thank you very much, then. This is Susan, and I would like to thank all of our presenters, Charmaine included, because that was really helpful, and I hope, Charmaine, you will be willing to come back on another call and keep us updated on what you're learning throughout this process. And I would thank Barry, Leslie, Jane, and Cindy for sharing their time and expertise. Folks who know me say, I always say this, but this is true, I think we got $1 million worth of consultation advice today from these experts. So thank you very much. Again, if you want to replay or hear parts of this call, check out the Resource Center's website, www.nrcoi.org. The call should be available for download within a couple of days. We will continue. This is the middle call, the one we're having today, in a series on training evaluation. Anita Barbie kicked us off a while ago talking about some basics about training evaluation. This call today, I think, gave us a really concrete example of how one state, albeit a huge state, is thinking about this process and some of the benefits and challenges they face. And we're thinking about one last call on this topic. So that will be in the spring, and it will be another opportunity to come back and think through the challenges ahead of us on as we think about evaluating our training and continually improving it. I have one last announcement, and I'm very excited about this. We have put together here at the NRC an extranet for this peer training network. Many of you know that periodically I send out requests for information. I get asked by a state, you know, has anybody done training on? Do you have curriculum on a particular topic? And I send out a request to you, and many of you respond back and send extraordinarily helpful information that we try to share back with the entire network. And we've decided that the volume of material is so significant and so rich that we have built an extranet, so requests for information will be out there as well as the responses. So it, I think, will make it a lot easier for all of us to keep track of this good information. We'll also have information on upcoming peer network calls and other child welfare training related information. So watch for a email from me announcing the address, and you should get that shortly, probably right after the first of the year, if not sooner. So we're very excited about that. I've looked at it. It's beautiful. I've used it. A couple of people that are members of the network have done some piloting of it and found it extraordinarily helpful. So that will be, I think, a big improvement and change for our network. So with that said, my thanks to everyone, especially our presenters today, for this lively, informative discussion, and I hope everyone has a very joyous and festive holiday season.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect. Everybody have a wonderful day.